Raising the Bets is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to Raising the Bets. We're a Catholic couple raising five kids outside of Boston. Join us as we share the joys and challenges of marriage, homeschool, and our adventures near and far as we make sense of the world and experience the best parts of our culture. I'm Don Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Melanie, one day more, and you'll have your computer back. Tomorrow, it's coming.
Uh-huh.
It was quick. It was a quick turnaround. Hopefully they're due to deliver tomorrow. You're going to have a child at a doctor's appointment. I'm going to be recording podcasts. And hopefully they don't ring the doorbell during that time period, because otherwise we're reliant on the ADD girl.
Well, I mean, it's just a telehealth meeting, so I could technically, like...
Oh, you're not going anywhere?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, then, you know, just jump up and go get your computer.
Right.
And then I can have my computer back. Ben can have his computer back.
He's not using it right now.
No. But
it's summer break.
It will be safe from you in water. This calumny against you. Oh, it's I have very few things I can use against you. So this is I'm taking advantage.
Yes, you are.
Because you can't deny it. I have all kinds of things you can use against me. So anyway, let's talk about our week, which was kind of boring.
This was a very quiet, rainy, do nothing sort of week.
Hey, surprise, it's been raining. Yeah, we had actually a day or two partial days of sun in there. But yeah, it was also been rainy and busy. The one thing we did do, though, is we had a Cub Scout meeting on Friday night, which we had, like, it was a critter day. It's a thing. This wasn't a thing when I was a kid. It's become a thing where, like, these people will come to your event, even birthday parties, and they'll bring, like, exotic animals. Exotic, quote unquote, you know, turtles, snakes, spiders, lizards of various kinds, and small mammals, rodentia.
I think it's cool. I think it's cool. Like,
yeah.
I mean, I had a friend when I was working one of my first jobs post college who kept snakes, and she had a big boa and she brought it to work one day, freaking out our boss.
yeah, find out if your boss has snake phobia.
Right. I've handled snakes, touched them, etc., but the kids hadn't, and they didn't really even know what, like, a snake felt like.
Yeah.
I think these are cool because, like, I think kids really get excited about...
Oh, my gosh.
About animals, but then also, like, they get to learn something, like, just knowing what a snake skin feels like.
Imagine a group of kids, 5 to 10, 11 years old, jumping out of their skins. At every animal, they were like, okay, everybody sit down on the floor, stay here behind this line. Within 15 minutes, they're like surrounding him like a crowd who wanted, like, the crowd surrounding Jesus and trying to throw him off the cliff. I mean, it's like, back up, everybody back up. Oh my gosh, they were jumping out of their skins. It was awesome. Yeah, so they had a milk snake, and it was started off kind of tame, you know, so they had a milk snake. There was some frogs that were kind of sticky, like slimy.
Okay.
And the kids got to hold those, so that's fun. There was a lizard of some sort. I forget what it was called. But Australian, but not deadly. There were a couple Australian animals, but not deadly ones. He had some turtles, like a wood turtle and a different box turtle, which the kids could hold. And then he brought out an alligator snapping turtle, which was kind of awesome because Anthony came to tell you all about it.
Oh yeah,
he's like rushes in, he snapped, like the guy had the turtle snap his jaws on a water bottle and just water sprays everywhere. It's very dramatic. It was cool. And then he brought an African tortoise, which was only 5 years old but was huge, like several feet across, and the kids all got to touch him, her, him, I'm not sure.
It.
Yes. We don't know its pronouns. And then He was talking about how when it's full grown, it'll be 200 pounds and will be like you could ride on it. And I'm like, I want one to ride around the yard on. To put a throne on his back and ride around the yard.
Uh-huh.
Wouldn't that be the most awesome thing ever?
Sure. Sure.
I am king of the yard. See me upon my throne of tortoise. And then, what else did he have? Oh, tarantula. So all of our kids were into all of the animals until he brought out the tarantula. Sophie and Anthony were willing to hold the tarantula. And that doesn't surprise me at all.
But what was funny was that Anthony later was like, Sophie was like, everybody held the tarantula. No.
It was just no. You and Anthony. It's like, I just didn't pay attention. She was so into it. I'm like, of course, she would be the one who'd be into tarantulas. She's like, I want one. No. If you got one, you would either the tarantula would go or you would go. the lizard was a gecko, the one that was earlier. And I remember that because it scratched Anthony's finger. And I'm like, oh, great. You're either going to get a superpower or you're going to get a superpower. And it's either going to be you can climb walls or you'll be able to sell insurance for a really good price.
Uh-huh.
That was my dad joke.
That was a very bad dad joke.
The other parents laughed. They thought it was funny. He almost finished. He was like, do we have time for any more? And Dan's like, sure, why not? And he's like, okay, I'll bring out the big one. And he goes and he pulls out a reticulated python, like a big seven foot snake. It was big. And all the kids, they got to wear it around their neck. They could pose for a picture. So I got pictures with all of them with it around their neck. Poor Bella was like weighed down with it. Oh, that was pretty cool. Oh, and the chinchilla. There was a chinchilla, which was...
Anthony had to tell me all about the chinchilla. He said it was so soft.
It was so... Like, I didn't get to touch any of them, but because the kids were all over them. But it was very cute and very small and very, very fluffy. Like, super fluffy. You can tell why they used to hunt them for their fur. So, it was fun. It was a good time. There was a lot of energy in that room with those kids. They were, oh my gosh. There was Olivia.
Uh-huh.
She was practically leaping at the guy as soon as he pulled an animal out. Like, she was literally hands forward diving at him every time and had to be pulled back.
I believe it.
She is very enthusiastic child. Yeah, that was funny. So that was good. And then, what was the other thing? Oh, the only other thing of note this week was I discovered that somebody in our house, no one is fessing up, have reprogrammed the home pods to call me not Dom, but Pizza Pizza 5 Pizza Pie Fart Ice Cream. No one is fessing up. And the best part is, I don't know how to change it. Because I tell it to like change the name. It says I can't do that. And then I looked it up and it's like, you just connected to the right account in your iCloud account, and it is connected to the right account, and it says nowhere Pizza Pizza 5 Pizza Pie Fart Ice Cream.
Annoying.
It's not a big deal because it doesn't say that except when it can't figure something. I'm sorry, Pizza Pizza 5 Pizza Pie Fart Ice Cream. I don't know how to do that.
Okay, the funny thing is, like, I would think that Anthony was the most likely candidate.
Yes.
Frankly. But I'm not sure that he would be able to articulate those words well enough for it to say.
He does have the stutter. Yeah. Well, actually, it could be a stutter. Pizza, pizza, five, pizza, pie, fart ice cream. Like, that could be a stutter right there.
Well, the R in fart. He has a hard time with that.
Yes, he has that accent. Also, they usually will fess up. Like I don't rage at them when they do this. Like, all right, who did this? And one of them would have laughed and fessed up by now. Might have denied it at first, but
maybe
someone else would have.
Could they have accidentally done it? Like they were talking and
it's possible because they're constantly in here having it tell them jokes.
So maybe they thought they were having it tell them a joke about pizza or farts or ice cream.
Yes.
And it's just they don't remember like
the... Tell me a fart joke. Tell me an ice cream joke. Tell me a pizza joke. Yeah, I'm sure it's entirely possible. Oh, so that's been so that's my new thing. I'm Mr. Tech here. I'm the Mr. Techie, and I can't figure out how to fix it. I can't wait because I'm going to contact Apple support, Apple Care.
Uh-huh.
And I can't wait to see their reaction when I say my HomePod calls me pizza pizza 5 pizza pie fart ice cream and I can't get it to stop. How do I change that?
You know, I almost wonder if like it thought that they said fart, but they didn't actually say fart because otherwise it sounds like a list of foods. Maybe
pizza,
they meant
pizza pie.
Pizza pie, pizza tart. Maybe.
Yeah. Our boys are more likely to say the word fart than they are to say tart. But OK, I think we've just said fart like 10 times in this episode. It is a banner episode. We are really scratching the bottom of the barrel in our quality of programming.
You know, when you raise boys, these things happen.
into every boy's life, farts must fall or something along those lines. Let's move on to talk about something a little more palatable, but still food-oriented, about what we've been cooking this week. So last night, I pulled out another new recipe called cumin-scented chicken, although it's an Indian dish, and its Indian name, which I'm going to mangle now. This is I just wanted to find the dish. You know, you'd think I would have thought ahead of time. Komdi Jira Galoon. I'm sure I said that wrong. And that's why I called it cumin-scented chicken. And so it was very interesting. It doesn't have turmeric in it. It has garlic and ginger, which is common in Indian curry-type dishes. But it does have paprika and cumin seeds. That's where it gets most of its flavor. And it was very interesting because it's like 3 tablespoons of cumin seeds, which is a lot, whole seeds. Then you toast them and then you grind them up. And boy, were they pungent. Like not in an annoying way, but really amazing smell.
It smelled awesome.
Yeah, the whole house smelled awesome for a whole day. And it goes in at the end. So it's not cooking it out. Any of the essential oil, not essential oils, any of the aromatics. It was a good good dish. I liked it.
It was yummy.
I would change some things about it. I did it as the recipe was in the cookbook or in the magazine, but I would add some vegetables, like maybe at least mushrooms, maybe some carrots, and I would make more sauce. The amount of sauce is about the amount of sauce you generally see in a curry dish, like in an Indian restaurant.
It's true.
Which is not a whole lot. I like more sauce. That way you put it on the rice and, you know, it kind of bulks it up a bit without having to add a lot more meat.
Right.
So there were a couple things I do, and I would simplify some steps to make it a little bit easier. But that was a pretty good recipe, I thought.
It was yummy.
Yeah. Sophie liked it. You and I liked it. Did anyone else like it?
I think Anthony ate some.
Anthony ate some, yeah. I think if the chicken were, it was these big hunks of chicken breast. That's the other thing I would do is I cut it into smaller bite size, size of the chicken, and then it would take less time to cook. And I think that was another thing that would have been better. So cumin scented chicken. And then tonight for dinner, we made another dish that was also out of Cook's Country. Can you tell I got the new issue of Cook's Country? Whenever the new issue comes of Cook's Country or Cook's Illustrated or Milk Street, I go through it and pull out all the recipes I want to try. So these were 2 that were in the most recent issues. And so this one was bourbon chicken, which apparently, from the article, is like a mall food court staple. I don't know. Not around here. Like, I wish this was at mall food courts.
Not that I've been to a mall food court.
In ages,
right.
Yeah.
Who knows?
But, well, the interesting thing is, the restaurant they profiled that, you know, that this came from is in New Orleans. And it's I think it was a Chinese restaurant. It might have been a Vietnamese restaurant, but they had like all kinds of dishes. They had pho, so it must have been Vietnamese. They had, but they also had lo mein, and they had po' boys and crawfish. Like, they had a little of everything. But this was the dish that people lined up for. And, yeah, it says it's a popular offering at Asian and Cajun-themed fast casual restaurants all over the nation, especially in mall food courts. I tell you, it was really good. I liked it. It uses bourbon. I didn't have any, like, cheap cooking bourbon, so I used Bulleit, which, it's like cooking with Dom Perignon. I mean, Bulleit's not the most expensive. It's not like Pappy's. But it's a little excessive. I only had a little left in the bottle, and it was like, it was literally this enough that the recipe called for, like 3 tablespoons left in the bottle. So I used it, but that might have contributed to how good it was.
It was good.
Yeah.
And for a side dish, I made curried beets and carrots,
yes,
which was a weird side dish to pair with the but it's
a bit of
like good.
Yeah. Yeah. The curry beet and carrot curry or curried beets and carrots, it was such an amazing color. Like, the color is the real attraction of this dish. It was so red.
Yeah. You saute some onions, and then you throw in a paste made out of the garlic and ginger. Then you add tomato paste, like half a can of tomato paste, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And then you add the beets and the carrots. And I added some cauliflower, too. Like ground up, like food processed cauliflower.
Yeah, blended in with the ginger and the garlic.
Yeah. And then, I added it later, but not.
Okay.
Like the ginger and the
garlic. But like the ginger and garlic, yeah.
And then you finished off with coconut milk. And the spices were very simple. It had some whole cumin seeds, some turmeric, and a green chili pepper. And that was about it.
Yeah. You used an Anaheim because that's what we had in the fridge. But you could use a jalapeno, too.
Yeah. I might actually make it with a little bit more heat next time. Like, I did not know how hot the Anaheim was going to be. And so I was kind of conservative. I didn't add any extra spice. But I think that it could have gone a little bit.
Could have added a little cayenne or something to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it was, the flavors are so good.
Yeah, it was really good.
I like the
sweet-ish, not sweetish, kind
of
sweet.
Right. The combination of the beets and the carrots and the coconut milk is a sweet.
Right. Sweet, but it's taste. Still a savory dish.
Right.
But it's just on the sweet end of the spectrum.
Yeah.
It was good. Yeah, it was a really interesting, good dish. I mean, I really like the flavor of it. We've had it before. It was a while ago, the last time we had it.
Yeah, I don't remember what I did last time. I think I tweaked some stuff this time.
So this time, did you boil the beets?
No.
You just cut them up and put them in.
I just cut them up and put them in. Now, I think it could have cooked a little bit longer on a higher temp because I was a little bit afraid to overcook it, but the beets and the carrots were a little on the
underdone side.
Chewy side.
Yeah, there's a little more crunch in the beets than you really want from beets.
Right.
Could have roasted them. I think roasting them.
If I'd had more time, that was my original intent, was to roast them in the toaster oven. Put oil on them and wrap them in foil and roast them until they were soft, and then cut them up and add them to the pot. And that might have been better, although the carrots would still maybe have been.
Yeah, you could roast carrots.
Good.
A little bit. Not as long as the beets, but a little bit, yeah.
But both the beets and the carrots were from the farmer's market, so they were really lovely and fresh.
Yeah. So, yeah, those are all good. And, the bourbon chicken is definitely, we're going to make that again. And Bella liked it. I mean, that was a popular one. Ben didn't really like it. And Lucy, like, took one bite. It's too much sauce, she says. I don't like ones with liquid. Dishes with liquid.
Liquid?
Yes. She wants, like, dry foods. I mean, the poor girl has been ruined by her allergens. It's like she has very definite tastes in textures and types of food that exclude lots of different things. So it's funny. So, all right. So that's what we've been eating. Of course, links to all the recipes will be in the show notes as usual. And then, all right, let's talk about what we've been reading and watching. I'm still working on my Revolutionary War history book.
Right.
Uh, So that's on the back burner. I'll tell you about two things I watched, and then you can tell me about all the things. Melanie watched all the things this week. But
all the things.
She'll tell you about that in a second. I watched a Netflix movie that starred Karen Gillan and Michelle Yeoh and Angela Bassett and Lena Headey. Lena Headey? Does that sound right? She was in Sarah Connor Chronicles. Remember that?
But I didn't
she was also in Game of Thrones.
I didn't watch that either.
Yeah. Anyway, Lena Headey, you know her. But a big all-star cast. Oh, and Paul Giamatti, you know, who's great. It was a terrible movie called Gunpowder Milkshake. It was a boring ripoff of the John Wick series. Like, I am sad for Karen Gillan that she made this movie because it was bad. It was just boring. It was just all super violence. A story I really didn't care about. Like, it was barely a plot. It was all milieu. It was all like the setting. It was all about the setting and not so much the story. And it was like not, it was cartoonish.
What was the setting?
So apparently her mother, Lena Headey plays her mother, and her mother belonged to an assassin's guild called the Librarians.
Karen Gillan's mother?
Yes. Played by Lena Headey.
Okay.
Called the Librarians, and they have a real library, and all the books have cutouts in them where they have weapons in. Which for reasons, like that makes no sense. There's no sense in it. Okay. And there are assassins for hire. Her mother disappears when she's a child. She has mother issues. Surprise. Then Karen Gillan's character becomes an assassin. And the movie starts with she's carrying out a job. She's apparently killed the son of somebody important. And the firm that she works for, the firm, that's all we really know. But it's this group of these old men, that's all we ever see, and Paul Giamatti is the go-between, disavow her and are going to throw her to the wolves to appease this other guy so that there isn't a war between them. And so she has to survive this guy coming at her, and then she has to go bring her revenge against the people who betrayed. It's the plot of John Wick, essentially. I mean, that's not the same. And there's a child that is the child of a guy that she's been sent to kill, who she rescues the child instead and bonds with. But it's just like, it was boring. It was ultra violent for no good reason. It was, yeah. Don't watch it. That's my, okay, I almost stopped watching it. Then I said, I saw there's like 20 minutes left. I'll just finish watching it. Maybe there'll be a cool action scene. And there wasn't. Anyway. So that was a waste of time. But then last night I watched A Quiet Place Part 2.
Uh-huh.
All right, so this is the sequel to the hit movie John Krasinski, Emily Blunt, where these creatures have showed up in the world who are blind, but have ultra good hearing and are ultra violent, like they'll kill anything that they hear making a noise, any creature. And so the survivors have to be super quiet all the time. And it's this family, and they have a deaf daughter and so on. So I won't spoil the first movie's ending, but the second movie starts with, like, the first movie is like 457 days into this event. But the second movie starts with day one. So you see it begin.
So you go back, you're going back in time before the first movie?
Yes.
Okay.
So that's where it starts, and you see it happen. Like, you just see the creatures show up that first day. And then it jumps ahead to the right where the first movie ended, like literally that right 5 seconds
that
later.
Second. Okay.
Yeah. And go from there. And it was good, but it was lacking something that the first movie had. And I think it had to do with the family element to it. There was a real family element to A Quiet Place. The mom, the dad, the children. There's a tension, but there's also a caring and a selflessness toward one another, and the way the family worked together. And that was kind of missing in this one. This one was more just about remember these really awful creatures, and now we're still trying to survive. It felt more like a people surviving in a dystopian world sort of thing. Like the first one wasn't really primarily about the creatures. It was about the family, and the creatures were the situation were the catalyst for what happens to the family. But it was really about the family. This one was more about the creatures. It was more conventional and as a conventional horror / alien movie. So that said, I still enjoyed it. At one point, I was the dramatic tension was so it was too much for me. I had to like pause and get up. You were out getting a glass of water from the some ice from the freezer. I'm like, I just taking a break because the tension is getting to me. There was quite a lot of dramatic tension in it, but it was good. It was good. It was worth watching. If you liked the first one, definitely watch the second one. There was there's a moment at the near the end of this. Where there's a sort of oasis, because these creatures they violently attack anything that makes a noise. There, throughout the whole of the two movies, there are no animal sounds. There's no birds, no squirrels, no dogs, cats. There's no creatures at all. And you don't really notice it until they get to this oasis. We'll call it. Where the creatures aren't for some reason, and you hear the birds and the creatures and you hear the normal sounds, and it's really weird. It's really jarring. I thought that was really well done. The sound design in both of these movies are fantastic because it's all about the sound.
Right.
Yeah.
Kind of like the Sound of Metal that I saw.
Right.
The sound was all, it was all about the sound.
Yes. Design. Yeah. I would think A Quiet Place, the first one, won the Academy for Sound Design because it was so good. So that's a bad movie and a good movie.
Excellent.
So tell us about all the movies you watched, Melanie.
So we finished watching the last episode of Loki.
The series. On Disney Plus, yep.
And I always felt like kind of lost. Not lost, like I didn't know what was going on, but lost, like I wasn't understanding. I didn't have the emotional impact. And a lot of my friends were raving about it. Like, this was awesome. It was great. And I was kind of feeling like, what did I miss?
What did I miss?
Yeah. So I decided to go back. Like, I realized that I'd watched all the Marvel movies pretty quickly and only once. And I hadn't really paid very much attention to Loki as a character my first time through. So I decided to go back and rewatch all the movies that had Loki in them. I watched Thor, and then I watched Avengers, and then I watched Dark World, and then I watched Ragnarok, and then I watched Infinity War. And yeah, one a night.
Yes.
It was
all the Loki movies. That's a lot of Tom Hiddleston.
It was a lot of Tom Hiddleston, and I'm not complaining. A lot of Chris Hemsworth, too, so.
I wouldn't complain about him.
And I have to say, they all made a lot more sense the second time through.
Mm.
Like, I was catching a lot more of the details, a lot more of the nuance, a lot more of the humor. I really felt like the MCU movies kind of need to be, they're so fast-paced. And there's a lot of stuff that they just kind of drop on you. Like you drop into a movie in the middle of the thing and it's just like going and going and going and going. And I felt like I just missed a lot of stuff the first time through.
Mm.
So this was good in that I feel a lot more situated. Now I kind of want to go back and watch the Loki series again and see if that makes more sense. I think that one of my problems with the Loki series, and I'm not saying I don't like it because I did like it, but I felt like I had sort of an emotional distance from it. I think part of that is just my lack of buy-in into the multiverse.
Yes.
Theory. The multiverse.
The concept as they envisioned it.
I feel like it's so open-ended that like when everything is possible, then nothing really has an impact. Like it's too big and open-ended. Like,
right.
It doesn't provide the constraints that good world building, what I like in terms of good world building, because it feels like there's too much possibility. And when they get to the end, I don't want to spoil it, but when they get to the end, I felt like they hadn't bought my
didn't earned it.
Didn't earned the ending.
Right.
Didn't earned the emotional impact.
Or the stakes.
Right. The stakes were too
high.
Too high. Too impossibly high. Like, not just, we're not just like saving New York City. We're not just saving the world. We're not just saving
the galaxy.
The galaxy.
Or half the population of the universe from Thanos.
Right. Now we're like saving the multiverse.
The multiverse and all of time and existence and its completion.
I just.
It's way too much.
I felt like I there wasn't enough grounding because the multiverse is just so wibbly wobbly, timey wimey. I didn't feel like there was like, why should I, if all realities are possible, then why should I care about this one versus that one? Like,
right.
What does it matter?
If this Loki dies, there's an infinite number of Lokis out there to replace him who are just like him or better.
Yeah.
I mean, if you think about it. Now, given the way that they've constructed their idea of the multiverse, it actually doesn't work that way. It's not really a multiverse of infinite possibilities.
Right. And that's but again,
which is kind of something that kind of pulled me out of it.
I feel like I didn't understand what the limitations and the constraints and the what it's all about. Like, what is the multiverse and why do I care? Like, that world building component just wasn't there for me.
Right. But what worked in the series was the small scale. It was the relationship between Sylvie and Loki between Loki and Mobius. And these small relationships are what worked best.
Right. And I feel like Loki's sort of personal growth, his character arc was good. It's just that the last episode kind of depended on more than just his personal character arc. It wanted me to buy into the mythology. And right. I just didn't feel like they'd explained it enough for me to buy in.
Right. Like, at the end of it, I'm going, wait, like, who's that? And what about what, like, I wanted answers and there weren't really answers.
And I recognize that these shows, the Disney Plus small serials, like WandaVision and Falcon and Winter Soldier and Loki, are all sort of smaller parts of a bigger story. But I felt like WandaVision and Falcon and Winter Soldier,
they were complete stories.
Were much more complete. And I felt like Loki felt just a little bit less complete.
It felt more like we're setting up the next phase of the MCU. It had to be open. Like, the WandaVision was the end of the previous phase. Falcon and Winter Soldier were sort of in between the two phases. They were more setting up Falcon than it was setting up the MCU. But this felt like we need to set up the multiverse of madness, which is what the Doctor Strange movie is going to be. This Doctor Strange movie is going to start phase two, and all the movies that roll out from that are, you know, in this phase are going to be about this. So that's one of the reasons I think why this feels so incomplete and open ended is because it's supposed to be.
Right. And I'm going to reserve judgment until I've seen more of phase two, because, like, again, like I said, like, watching the movies for the second time, I felt like I got more out of it. I got more into it. And so I'm willing to sort of give them time to draw out the story. And maybe it will turn out that I will like it better as I get into it. But for now, I'm just kind of like, it doesn't quite work for me.
So what did you think of Dark World on a second watch compared to the other movies?
Well, I didn't actually watch Dark World the first time through because you told me not to bother.
Right. That's what you did. What did you think of Dark World?
Well, there was a lot in it that I felt like, okay, that now this makes more sense, because I had missed Frigga's death and Loki's, like, the whole Loki and Thor working together to defeat
the Svartals and
like there was a lot in there.
In my defense, when I told you not to watch Dark World, I didn't know about the Loki series and that would be important,
right? So, yeah, I mean, I thought, I felt like in terms of Loki's character arc, now, granted, the Loki series actually resets Loki to before Dark World, right?
Right. It's the end of the first Avengers movie.
But in the series, I mean, this isn't too spoilery. He finds out about what happens.
He finds out about all the events that follow.
We find out what happens to him in the alternate timeline. He sees it and learns from his other self, the other branch.
Yes.
Informs who he is in the series, which I thought was interesting. I mean, it gave him they had to reset his character because because he dies.
Right.
That's not too spoilery, right? He dies.
If you're going to watch the Loki series, you will have already seen Avengers Infinity War. And
exactly.
If you care about it at all, you've seen it.
So he's dead. And so we reset him to an earlier point in the timeline and then like follow him from there. But he's still able to learn from some of the mistakes and experiences he had in the established timeline. And I liked that. That was one of the things I thought the series did well, was that happens pretty early on, and that informs who Loki is as you move forward. So that he's not like, he hasn't lost the possibility of learning from those experiences, even though he hasn't personally experienced them.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, he's still pretty arrogant at the beginning of the series, but by the end, he's changed a lot. And it'll be interesting to rewatch it and to see the anticipation of who this other Loki is that they're tracking down and how they talk about this other Loki. And then when they finally encounter this other Loki.
Right.
I'm being very careful how I talk about this. But yeah, it'll be interesting to rewatch and to see it in light of what we know about how it ends and the language that's used. So yeah, there's a second season coming. I'm curious when that will be, whether it will come out before or after the Doctor Strange movie.
Right.
So I'm curious. It's the only one that I know of, because I don't think Falcon got a second season. Maybe it did. I'll have to look that up again. But WandaVision didn't. Pretty sure it didn't. So, anyway.
How would you do another?
Well, that would be the trick. Well, that one guy that flew off at the end.
I suppose.
Yeah, would have to be that guy.
Anyway, so yeah, my experiences in the MCU continue apace, and I'm getting deeper and deeper into it. Now I need to go back and catch up on Clone Wars. Because the kids have now finished.
They've finished the Clone Wars. The
Clone Wars series. And I am still in season 2. I'm so far behind. I think partly I'm so far behind where they are now that I almost feel like, what's the point? Like, I'm never going to catch up. I've got that.
Okay, but I've given you the short version of the
things
to watch. Right.
And I'm still.
It's time to watch those. The kids, I won't spoil for you, season 7. But them, just their reaction coming out of the office, like Sophie was literally crying. The end of season 7 is a very emotionally affecting. Like, you know what happens. This is all prior to Rogue One and A New Hope. I mean,
right.
The event. So you know where the story is going. You know what's going to happen. We've seen Revenge of the Sith. You know, we know what happens. But still, to see it is very affecting. And that was something. In fact, I peeked in on them as they were watching, and it was right at the moment, a key moment in the story where everything was going to, like, literally the next scene, everything was going to change. And I kind of peek in, and I'm like, oh, boy. I close the door. I kind of wish I'd come in and watched it with them and experienced it with them, but.
You were cooking.
But I was cooking. Yeah, yeah. So, all right. So you had a book that you finished, too.
I did.
Tell us about it.
Okay, so I started this book, like, last year, the year before last, a long time ago. I had it out from the library and then returned it. And then halfway finished. And then bought it, but it took me a while to get back to actually reading it. So it's called The Warmth of Other Suns by Isabel Wilkerson. It's nonfiction, but it's narrative nonfiction. So it tells the story of the Great Migration, which is the movement of Black Americans out of the southern United States to the Midwest, Northeast, and West. And it spans a big period of time from about 1915 to 1970. So most of the 20th century.
Right.
And I mean, this is an exodus of about 6 million people moving from one internally in an internal migration as opposed to a immigration.
Immigration.
And yet they follow a lot of the same patterns of migration that happens with people moving into the United States from other countries, which is you'll have one or two people who arrive in a place and then more people from the homeland come to that place. Like you have clusters.
Mm-hmm.
So interesting thing about the way this book is structured is she picks three people to follow. There's Ida Mae Gladney, who leaves Mississippi in 1937. She was a sharecropper and she moves to Chicago. And then you have George Starling, who was worked in the orange groves in Florida and who moves to New York City. And then you have Robert Foster, who left Louisiana and goes to California. He's a surgeon. And you start from the 30s. Ida Mae leaves in the 30s. George Starling leaves in the 40s and Robert Foster leaves in the 50s. So she uses them to kind of look at three different regions in the South, Florida, Mississippi, and Louisiana, and also three different regions in the
outside the South.
Right. The locations to which they travel. So George goes to New York. Ida Mae goes to first Milwaukee and then Chicago. And then Robert Foster goes to California. And so we see these. So she uses them as sort of the spine and then tells a lot of other stories around it, both the story of why people were leaving, but also the story of what happens when they get to where they're going.
And to clarify, this is a nonfiction. I when you were telling me about this the first time, I got it messed up in my head. I thought it was a novel, but this is a nonfiction story. These are real people, real stories.
Right. So Isabel Wilkerson was a reporter and a journalist, rather. And she spent years researching this book and talked to thousands of people. These were the sort of the thousands of people who she interviewed. These were the people who had the stories that sort of worked best as a spine. And she continued to have this long-term friendship with the three of them and continued to have a relationship with them until their deaths. And so their deaths actually are sort of a part of the narrative of the story too. And it's clear that she develops a close personal relationship. Like she talks about going to their funerals and being with their families, and she travels with them. Like she takes them back to the places they're from. And so there's this whole like richness and contextualization. And she really has done a lot of research into the statistics and the data.
Yeah.
But then it's supported by this narrative, which really sort of pulls you through. And the book constantly goes from one to the other to the other. So you're constantly shuffling between these three stories and then branching out from them to talk about sort of other migrants in the same areas.
Hmm.
And it's this whole pattern of movement and culture, and it really sets the scene for what happens in the 20th century in the United States in a way that this is not like any other history book I've read. And it's not, I mean, I'd never even heard of the Great Migration until I read this book. And when you think about it, 6 million people moving is migrating.
Right. Well, and it explains a lot about a lot of the things that happened in the 20th century, the late 20th century in racial issues and just the upheavals in society. There were the Watts riots in California in the 60s. And then there was the all the various urban crises, like busing and other stuff in the 70s. And a lot of this stuff developed as people moved and there was disruption in community.
Right. She also sort of breaks up, investigates and sort of does a lot of busting of myths, which is a lot of the narrative was that it was these poor rural immigrants coming to the North that were bringing disruption and problems with them.
Right.
And she said the data actually doesn't bear that out. In fact, they tended to be the more stable community with the more stable marriages and the better, more stable education.
Well, they're the ones who would have the resources and wherewithal to uproot and travel.
Right. And she talks about sort of very interesting, like, trends and patterns, the way people would continue to have these back and forth relationships with where they came from. And they would establish these communities of, like, you would have a community of immigrants from Texas.
Right.
Or immigrants from Florida. And they would have clubs, like, where people would meet and talk about home. And
well, we see that in other kinds of migrations. Like, in Florida, there are places like Tampa, which is like New York City South, because a lot of people retiring from New York City, the New York area, the tri-state area, move to the Tampa area.
Right. And then you also see things like the Polish club or the German club or the Italian club. Right. And so we had these same sorts of social phenomena. But interestingly enough, a lot of the people in the Great Migration don't think of themselves as migrants or immigrants, even though they follow a lot of the same pattern, because in their minds, they're still in the same country. They're still Americans. They started off as Americans and they continue to be Americans. But in terms of like the cultures, the food ways, the music, all of that, they're bringing with them.
I wonder, it would also, there's the mindset about moving long distances is different today than it was 100 years ago. 100 years ago, people did not generally move as far from home as we do at the drop of a hat now. People move halfway across the country to get a new job. But back then, people generally lived in the same place that their parents and grandparents lived.
And you wonder, though, like, how does the Great Migration change, in fact, how mobile within the U.S. people are? Like,
that's what I'm thinking.
Right.
Yeah.
This ability of people to move back and forth. And one of the interesting strands of the narrative was that George Starling, who moves to New York, is a conductor on the train that goes from New York City to Florida. And that's, he spends his entire life until he retires as a conductor on this same
train. Going back and forth.
Going
back and forth. The place that he was from and the place he moved to.
Right. And he had started off on a college education before he left Florida, but then things got bad and he had to leave. He had been involved in trying to...
Civil rights
movement.
Yeah.
And he basically had to like run for his life. And so you kind of see that, like, over time, the patterns of people going back and forth. A lot of his kids ended up moving back to Florida. So it wasn't just a one way street.
Right.
Too. There was a back and forth, people moving, traveling.
You see that with external migration. Like when we lived in Salem, there was a very large Dominican population there. And there was a very easy movement between like people moving back to the Dominican Republic, coming back to Salem. There was less of a, like my grandparents leaving Sicily. We've left. We're never going back again. That's
right.
It. And but now that with the ease of international or internal travel, it doesn't have to be that way. And so those old connections to the old place remain.
Right. And a lot of the patterns of migration had to do too with train lines. Like people ended up, you know, moving from Mississippi to Chicago because of that particular train route.
Right.
Or there were like where people ended up in Detroit or whatever. Like they came from specific places to specific places, partly because they were following trains.
Interesting.
As well as following job opportunities.
Right. Right. That is interesting. It sounds like a good book.
It's really, really well written. And you can tell that the author is so passionate about the subject matter, about the people, about the culture. She herself is the child of migrants.
Right.
So she's kind of telling her personal story as well. And I feel like that passion for what she's writing comes through. And it's just such an engaging book. It's very long, but I didn't feel like it ever dragged or got tedious. There's a few places where she kind of repeats information because the last time she told you was a while back. And so there's a little bit of repetition just to kind of refresh your memory, but it's not too much.
Right. I think it sounds like, you know, if you want to kind of understand where we are today as a country, this is would help inform that.
Definitely.
Probably this better than a lot of the other more contemporary popular stuff now.
Right, because she's not writing an argumentative book. It's really a historical, sociological
not a polemic. It's not trying to push an agenda or force.
No, it's just about understanding more clearly.
This is what happened.
Who we are as a country. Because this affects, you know,
affects
all
everyone.
Of us.
Right. 6 million people moving internally is a massive change. Yeah.
And of course, African-American culture is American culture in a way, like all American music and American food ways are so enmeshed in the African-American experience that it's really part of who all of us are.
Right.
You know, whether we're white, black, whatever, you know, it's right.
Apart from the politics, which is everything today. But just from a historical cultural point of view, I think it does behoove us to understand African-American culture as much as we need to understand Irish-American and Italian-American culture if we are ourselves Irish or Italian in our roots. But to understand the African-American experience is to understand America.
Right. Who we are as a country is it's not their experience. It's our experience, really.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. And yeah. And it's not. It's a multifaceted question. It's not about one issue, which some people make it.
Right. And, you know, and some of the stories are fascinating. I wish I could get into like all of the personalities. I loved especially Robert Foster, the surgeon. He started serving as a doctor in World War II. And he was really, really brilliant surgeon. And then he ends up moving to California and having to sort of start from scratch.
Right.
And he becomes the personal physician of Ray Charles. And so he has this great relationship with Ray Charles,
oh, wow.
Which is really fun.
Huh.
And he was in L.A. He was hobnobbing with a lot of the Hollywood elites. And yet he had to sort of claw his way up.
Right. Interesting. That sounds good. Sounds like a good book. The Warmth of Other Suns.
Right. And the title comes from a poem by Richard Wright.
Okay.
There's a lot of really great, every chapter begins with an epigraph from a poem or fiction. So there's kind of a thread through to of literature,
mm-hmm.
which I love that too.
Oh, someone was ranting about epigraphs recently. I forget who
it was. Jimmy Akin.
Oh, that's what he was. Jimmy.
Jimmy hates. It was like,
Jimmy hates epigraphs.
I was like, I love the epigraphs. That's my favorite part. Sometimes I love the way they inform a chapter. And Jimmy was
well
totally ranting about
there are it's in certain kinds of books. Certain kinds of epigrams are actually annoying. But so I get that. But not in every book. I agree.
These were really thematically appropriate in terms of, because we're talking about culture and literature, and they allowed her to get more of the
right to give you a taste
literary
of the culture
element.
And the literary element. Okay, good. So that's what we've been reading and watching a lot.
Yeah, we've been busy.
Yes. So let's talk about this week's gospel and other readings, the mass readings for this week. It's kind of funny. The only thing I will say about this is this past Friday, Pope Francis issued his motu proprio custodius traditionis, I think it was, about the celebration of the extraordinary form of the Mass. And people pointed out that the first reading from Jeremiah, which begins with "Woe to the shepherds who mislead and scatter the flock in my pasture," they were kind of laughing. Oh, it seems appropriate this week. But it was interesting. So the first reading is about, you know, the shepherds have to care for the sheep, and those who don't properly care for the flock, woe to them. And because if they don't, the Lord will replace them and find ones who will. And then we have the Psalm 23 for the responsorial psalm, "The Lord is my shepherd."
Right. In a way, this was almost like sort of Good Shepherd Sunday part two.
That's what I was wondering. I'm like, wait, this isn't Good Shepherd Sunday again. No, it's not. And then the gospel is interesting because it's the apostles have returned. Remember, we're talking about they went out two by two. They've come back, reported all they had said and done and taught. And so Jesus recognizes, okay, all you introverts, we need to now go to a place to recharge. We're going on retreat.
Right. They retreat into the desert so that they can, because they can't even find time and space to eat.
Because everybody has come. They want to see the miracle workers. They want to hear the great teaching. And I love the gospel has that little note. They even had no opportunity even to eat. So they went off on a boat. To go across the Sea of Galilee to a different place, and people said, "Hey, they're going over that way. let's go around and catch up to them. If we go fast, we can get there ahead of them. And they did. And they arrived at the place before them. And I love this detail. When he disembarked and saw the vast crowd, his heart was moved with pity for them, for they were like sheep without a shepherd, and he began to teach them many things. Like, it's such a parent moment. Like, Jesus is the parent there. Like, I'm exhausted. I just need 15 minutes. But you need to be fed, so I will feed you.
It is one of my favorite moments in all of the Gospels, I have to say. Jesus trying to go out into the desert, trying to find a retreat, and yet, despite his own personal needs and the needs of the apostles, when he sees the needs of the people, that just, it's not just that I have a duty and an obligation, but he's moved.
With pity, but which is, he'll move by love.
He loves them, and he sees that they need him, and they need shepherding. And that's who he is. He's the shepherd.
Right. So this gospel really contrasts with the first reading from Jeremiah. Like, he's the one that the reading from Jeremiah says, the Lord will appoint new shepherds. Yeah, that one. He's the new shepherd to replace the bad shepherds. So I really love that aspect of it. This idea of Jesus just, you know, even to the last drop, even when he's got nothing, you know, I mean, he's always got more to give. He's God. But in his humanity, even when it feels like there's no more to give, when he really needs to take a moment, when he really needs to take a time out, he's going to just go on, and because he needs to serve his flock. So I really love that part. So today's celebrant for the mass we went to at our parish was a new priest, Father Elias.
A visiting priest.
I'm sorry, a visiting priest, but new to us. His last name, it sounds like an African name.
And I can't remember it now. I looked it up. It starts with an O. It sounded like a Nigerian name to me.
Right. Possibly Nigerian, possibly Kenyan, but probably Nigerian, since Father Michael is from Nigeria, and that might be why. He's apparently in one of the local colleges, but also doing some hospital ministry.
Yeah, I think he's...
He's probably getting an advanced degree locally and helping out in parishes while he's here.
Right.
So... his homily, though, was really good. He started by singing Amazing Grace.
Which was awesome.
Which was
awesome.
And everyone joined in.
Right. He started singing, and immediately, like, the congregation was, like, totally with him the whole way.
Right. And he sang first verse, and then he's like, can we do the second one? Let's do the second one. And so we sang the second verse of Amazing Grace. And I love it because we both used to sing Amazing Grace especially to Bella and Sophie, when they were babies, to get them to go to sleep.
I continue to sing Amazing Grace every single night. I think when Sophie was like when Anthony was a baby still, I was still singing Amazing Grace nightly. I mean, I know that song very well.
Yes.
Yes, I can sing all the verses.
Yeah. And so so the girls they always love to hear it being sung and love to sing along with it, I know, especially. And so that was nice. But the reason he, I'm trying to pull up the lyrics. I know some Catholics are like, oh, it's not appropriate for a mass hymn. And so it wasn't being sung as a hymn. He was just singing it. And there's plenty of it that is worth singing. You know, even if some of the theology is not quite Catholic correct, there's plenty of it is. But he sang it because I was trying to, there was that one line in the second verse, which, there are different versions, and I'm trying to find the lyric. The end of the second verse, which is, the third verse is when we've been there for 10,000 years.
'Twas grace that taught my soul to fear, and grace my fears relieved. How precious did that grace appear the hour I first believed.
Right.
They use something about how precious the grace is.
How precious grace is. And he went into talking about how important it is that we are the shepherds of our children, not just the priests, the teachers, the parents, government officials. We are all the shepherds of our children, and we should be teaching them the truth. And why are our churches empty? Because we're not teaching the truth. And, you know, there's so much falsehood out there, so much of that is not true, that people like that is so blatantly not true out there. So a denial of reality. And we have to be giving the truth to our children. They deserve it. They have a right to it. And I mean, he was on fire. He was passionate.
He was really, really good.
It was a great homily. He has a strong accent, so you have to really pay attention. But it was really good. I'm not sure if the kids got it. I should have asked them if they'd heard, if they understood much. They've actually gotten a real education in our parish because all of the priests have accents of one kind or another. Father Michael has the Nigerian accent. Father Joachim is Cape Verdean.
We've almost always, because we have the two immigrant communities, the Haitian and the Cape Verdean, we usually have priests assigned, parochial vicars assigned to minister to Haitian and Cape Verdean. So they're from Haiti and Cape Verde because they speak the particular Creoles. Because in Cape Verde, they speak a Portuguese Creole. It's not Portuguese. It's
a version.
Brazilian Portuguese or Portugal Portuguese. And same in Haiti, the French they speak is a Creole French.
Right. And then you have Father Michael, who's Nigerian. So he's got a strong accent. And then the Indian priest who helps out, who comes from Father Pinto. Father Pinto, who comes from the family prayer center.
Father Peyton Prayer Center.
Father Peyton Prayer Center, yes. And there's a couple of local-born, native-born Boston priests who don't have strong accents, and they're completely understandable if you're from Boston. But Father Elias was on fire. It was a great homily. It was really good. So I have to admit, I did not look up Mother Sophia's reflection for the week.
I actually did, and she was mostly talking about they are going on retreat this week, She was talking about the experience of retreat and going to the desert, which was again building on the idea of Jesus going on retreat and talking about sort of the importance of it was really interesting because she kind of talked about how the Benedictines, unlike the Franciscans or the Dominicans, there's sort of an emptiness in them where they are contemplative so that they can enter into prayer and intercession for the vast crowd of humanity. And she kind of connected it to Jesus having the concerns and the cares of the crowds sort of that he, you know, they all come and they pile their concerns on him. And she says, you know, for the Benedictines, although they're in their cloister, they're praying, interceding for so many people because people come to them and say, sister, pray for this, sister, pray for that. And so they are there in their cloister, their community in the desert, being sort of mobbed by all of these prayer requests from everyone. And that's what they're there for. They're there to pray and intercede for the world. So it was really kind of beautiful in terms of them connecting their ministry of prayer and contemplation with Jesus going into the deserted places.
You know, retreat is one of those things I wish you and I could do them. We should do them more often, is to get an opportunity to take a weekend away.
This is true.
We need to find time to do that. I know my brother and his wife, they have made that a priority for them, and I think it works for them, and I think it would be good to go away on retreat occasionally. I think it would benefit both of us to be able to do that.
You know, Mount St. Mary's actually offers retreats. Like you can pay to stay in their little retreat house, and
they have a little hermitage there, which would be fun.
But yeah, you can stay there, and like they provide food and.
But you stay like they bring the food to the little hermitage, or do you eat with them?
I think that they have food that you
prepare yourself. Right, like simple food, like sandwiches and things. Yeah. Or you could bring food, I suppose. That'd be interesting. There's also the Arnold Hall retreats that John's always telling me about. I went to one once. I went on one of those once a long time ago. They're silent retreats. They're Opus Dei retreats. Arnold Hall's nice. I have to tell you, it is really nice, and it's not that far. We should think about that. All right, let's wrap things up. I want to take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create Raising the Bets, including Judson G., KCT, Carl W., Deborah A., and Maria C. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue Raising the Bets and all the shows at StarQuest. You can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. So that's it from us. We'd love to hear your feedback on anything we've talked about. You can do so by commenting at sqpn.com/bets. That's BETTS. Or the SQPN Facebook page, facebook.com/StarQuestMedia. Or send an email to bets@sqpn.com. And links from our discussion to all the things we talked about will be in our show notes at sqpn.com. Please write a review of the podcast at Apple Podcasts. It's been a long time since we've had a review. It would really help us a lot if you gave us one there to help us boost the algorithm. And then also share the podcast with your friends to help us grow this community of listeners. Until next time, I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Thank you for listening to Raising the Bets on StarQuest.